A commentator for youth radio has become more interested in the events of his parents' home country, Iran. Arash Afghahi still has family there, but it took this summer's election and the protests that followed to make him feel Iranian.
Growing up, I didn't feel a strong connection to Iran. I wasn't born there, and I've only visited once in my life. As a kid, I remember tuning my dad out every time he talked about Iranian politics. And they were definitely conversations to avoid around the dinner table, because they usually ended with him dropping the F word, fascist. My dad seemed addicted to conspiracy theories involving the government. I always figured that it couldn't be as bad as he said it was. But now, I sympathize with my dad a lot more. When millions of people began protesting the Iranian election results, it suddenly felt very personal. My aunt and uncle from Iran were actually visiting me in New York on the day of the election. Their daughter is just 2 years older than me, and she volunteered for Mousavi's campaign, doing basically what young volunteers do here in the States, handing out literature and putting up posters. But that proved dangerous after the election. She called my uncle often in the early days of mass protests and police crackdowns. After one of these conversations, my uncle grimly told my aunt that someone had taken their daughter's license plate. They told me this was a common strategy used by Iranian police against critics of the government. When people like my cousin report their missing license plate, the police arrest them. When my aunt returned to Iran, she retrieved the license plate from my cousin without any repercussions from the police. But my family considers the incident a thinly veiled threat. We worry that my cousin could herself disappear if she continues her vocal opposition and protesting. Now, I try to stay in touch with my cousin as much as I can. But lately, my cousin's Facebook updates and Twitter messages have become less frequent, and I'm left to wonder why. Not knowing is the hardest part for me. All I can do is worry about my family in a country that seems so far away, but is also mine.
Commentator Arash Afghahi is a student at New York University. His essay was produced by Youth Radio, and you can comment on it on the opinion page at our website, npr.org. Here in the U.S., employment reports in recent months suggest there's not much hiring going on, but there could be. An annual survey released yesterday by two staffing firms says most employers are planning to hire full-time workers in the next 12 months. NPR's Yuki Noguchi has more.
With unemployment at 9.4%, the conventional wisdom has been that hiring will be slow to recover and that applicants will outnumber available jobs.
What we're finding is that employers are more optimistic today than they were, you know, 3 or even 6 months ago.
Jennifer Grass is a spokeswoman for CareerBuilder.com, one of the firms that, along with Robert Half International, sponsored the survey. 53% of the 500 companies surveyed said they plan to add full-time jobs within the next 12 months. About 40% said they plan to hire part-time employees. Grass says candidates for jobs that require specialized skills are still getting paid premiums, even in this down economy. Pay raises will also make a comeback, the survey said. Hiring freezes will start to thaw, and employers are starting to talk about reinstating benefits that were recently cut back. Grass says jobs in technology, sales, and customer service will be among the first jobs available because those help companies add or retain revenue and profit. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. If the knee bone is connected to the thigh bone, then why doesn't your primary care doctor know what your orthopedist is doing? One of the problems with American healthcare today is that it's uncoordinated. And one of the promises made by advocates of healthcare reform is that in a new system, doctors and hospitals would do a little more communicating. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports on why most people's healthcare is disjointed now and how it might come together in the future.
Get a bunch of health policy strategists together and you'll hear the phrase a lot, coordinated care. Anne O'Malley with the Center for Studying Health System Change.
Coordinated care refers to the integration of healthcare across all of a patient's needs, conditions, the different clinicians that person sees, and the different settings where the patient receives care.
76-year-old Ben Barr knows what coordinated care means. He's a retired electronics engineer. He likes systems, and he likes Kaiser Permanente, where all the doctors and nurses work together and share a computer system. Barr has diabetes, which can cause eye problems, so his primary care doctor sent him to a Kaiser ophthalmologist.
He sat down looked at the computer, and immediately he had my entire history as far as the diabetes is concerned and to what degree I am bothered by it.
Barr doesn't have to labor through his medical history every time he sees a different specialist. At the Geisinger Clinic in Pennsylvania, Connie Ginger's doctor does the work of some specialists. She doesn't have to go to the hospital for a blood test or a pap smear. In a more limited approach to coordinated care, there's disease management programs where, if, say, you have diabetes, you see a nutritionist and an educator and a doctor who all work together. Patients and policymakers love coordinated care. Why isn't there more of it? Alan Garber, who directs the Center for Health Policy at Stanford University, says it's money.
The biggest obstacle to establishing coordinated care in routine clinical settings in the U.S. is not so much that doctors and hospitals aren't organized to provide it, although that is certainly a factor, but that very often they have no financial incentive to do so.
Most doctors don't get paid for talking to one another or to you. They don't get paid for tracking down an X-ray or biopsy result. They do get paid for doing new ones. Whether coordinated care would save money is unclear. A recent analysis of 15 Medicare projects showed no significant reductions in hospitalizations, no net savings, and little improvement in quality. But studies of people with congestive heart failure treated by a team show better care and a 30% reduction in costs. Proponents of coordinated care say it's a matter of designing the right kind of program. The current Senate and House health overhaul bills address care coordination obliquely. They would add money for more Medicare pilot programs. Analyst Anne O'Malley hopes they'd show better results.
So that the left hand knows what the right hand's doing, so that providers are communicating with each other and most importantly with patients, and so that we're not doing unnecessary things to patients or duplicate testing, and that we can avoid unnecessary hospitalizations by better primary care.
If these pilots work, it could prove to private insurance companies that coordinated care is worth the effort. And in fact, some are already trying it. And Stanford's Alan Garber says that plans for a central exchange to buy health insurance could promote coordinated care.
If care coordination works as well as we think it does, it will certainly be higher quality and lower cost.
And people who go to the exchange to buy their insurance would be able to see the effects in the grades that the plans get and shop for those that will give them a doctor who makes sure they get the care they need, no more and no less. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
Three Books is our series in which writers recommend three books on one theme. Today, Jake Halpern sends us his selections, and they just might save your life.
Just after getting married, my wife and I had a seaplane drop us off deep in the backcountry of New Zealand. With an emergency locator beacon in hand and a week's worth of provisions in our packs, we set out on our honeymoon. We soon reached a hut with a few cots, a potbelly stove, a bag of macaroni, and a note that read, "Fishermen were here. Left some food. Enjoy." My wife and I unpacked our bags and then stepped out for a stroll. Upon our return, we discovered a family of New Zealanders devouring our provisions. Apparently, they read the fishermen's notes, saw our unpacked food supplies, thought this was the fishermen's food, and had themselves a feast. "What are we going to do?" asked my wife as she looked around at our dwindling food supply. Now, I wish I could tell you that this was my MacGyver moment, that I made a fishing net out of dangling tree moss and fed us for a week. But I had no reply to this question. It was humiliating. And we barely ate for the next week. After surviving this ordeal, I discovered a wonderfully delicious genre of literature that will appeal to men and know-it-alls of all varieties. Survival books. First, let me suggest The Worst Case Scenario Survival Handbook by Joshua Piven and David Borgenicht. It offers advice on how to escape from quicksand, land a plane, or survive if, say, well, your parachute fails to open. The language is pithy. So pithy you could probably finish reading the chapter on quicksand while still sinking in the sand. Then you could simply maneuver onto your back, spread out your arms and legs, and float towards safety. Or so says the book. For more nuanced advice, I suggest When All Hell Breaks Loose by Cody Lundeen. Lundeen explains how to treat wounds, purify water, and of course, how to cook mice and rats over a campfire. There is even a detailed section that discusses what to do when a loved one passes away because, as Lundeen puts it, You may be required to cowboy up and dispose of the body yourself. If you're truly serious about surviving, pick up a copy of SAS Survival Handbook by John Wiseman, who was a veteran of Britain's legendary Special Air Service. This is an encyclopedic work with detailed drawings of medicinal plants, poisonous snakes, and easily buildable Arctic shelters. True survival, the reader soon realizes, depends upon such mind-numbingly boring tasks as tying complicated knots or knowing the difference between cumulus clouds and nimbostratus clouds. What really matters, however, is that the next time that I'm in a crisis and my wife beseeches me for my opinion, at long last, I'll have something to say, thanks to these three books. Now that's peace of mind.
Jake Halperin is the author of the new novel Dormia, about a young boy who has more than a few brushes with death. Halperin's three books are The Complete Worst-Case Scenario Survival Handbook by Joshua Piven and David Borgenicht, When All Hell Breaks Loose by Cody Lundeen, and The SAS Survival Handbook by John Wiseman. You'll find more recommendations for summer reading, and you can always tell us what books you cannot survive without, all at the books section of our new website, npr.org.
Come this fall, Major League Baseball could approve the largest deal in the history of the game. The billionaire Ricketts family of Nebraska reached an agreement last week to buy a controlling interest in the Chicago Cubs from the financially troubled Tribune Company. For about $800 million, the Ricketts family would gain control of one of the most storied teams in baseball, and not just the team, but also its historic home, Wrigley Field. What's not clear is what Cubs fans might get out of the deal. From Chicago Public Radio, Alex Keefe reports.
Peanuts! How about a big old bag?
Just around the back of Wrigley Field, die-hard Cubs fans are lining up to get their spots in the outfield bleachers. These are familiar stomping grounds for 59-year-old Chris Gorski.
At 7 years old, I was coming here taking the bus by myself.
Gorski says he's excited by the prospect of having new owners for the Cubs. The Ricketts made their fortune by founding the online brokerage firm TD Ameritrade, and Gorski's hoping their entrepreneurial drive can finally get the team what it's been chasing for more than a century, a World Series title. But he quickly lapses into nostalgia about Wrigley Field.
Now, I guess what's nice about it is that it really hasn't changed much from the time I was 7 years old to the time I'm now, and that's nice. You like that stability.
And there is the rub. Many fans like Gorski are hoping for dramatic changes if the Ricketts family gains control of the Cubs, but they're also protective of the team's rich tradition.
We really have no idea how this franchise is going to change because they simply haven't given us any information.
That's Gene Wojciechowski, a senior columnist for ESPN.com. He says it's no wonder the Ricketts have maintained a media blackout since they started bidding for the team. They've slogged through more than a year of delicate negotiations, complicated by Tribune's bankruptcy filing in December and an 11th-hour bidding war. Wojciechowski says now he's waiting to see what happens next.
We don't know if Lou Piniella is going to be the manager next year, if they're going to blow up Wrigley Field, if they're going to tear down the scoreboard and put up a jumbotron.
No one from the Ricketts family agreed to be interviewed for this story. Spokesman Dennis Culleton says that's because the deal still needs approval from Major League Baseball and a bankruptcy judge. He's hoping that will happen this fall.
In the meantime, they're going to be respectful of those two very important steps.
Culleton won't speculate about changes in team leadership or in Wrigley Field, but he will say the Ricketts are lifelong season ticket holding Cubs fans who appreciate the experience of a game at Wrigley.
What you'll see in this new era is a family that is very smart, very successful, and they're going to bring that to the Chicago Cubs.
T-shirts! Get your T-shirts! Cubs souvenirs, sir! T-shirts!
Back outside the friendly confines, 28-year-old fan Adam Beck waits near the gate to get players' autographs. He's here making his annual pilgrimage from Michigan to see his beloved Chicago Cubs. And he has a message for the Ricketts family.
Bring home a World Series. literally, bring home a World Series. This is what this town needs.
That may require some patience, but Cubs fans seem to have plenty. For NPR News, I'm Alex Keefe in Chicago.
Hey, anything could happen. It's only been 101 years.